Hello there, this is VK3OTN, the official station of the Radio Amateurs Alzheimer's Club of Australia, with this month's news and information bulletin for September 2022 for members and friends of the club. I am Andrew, a VK3 Charlie Alpha Hotel. Details of times and frequencies of when to hear these broadcasts are available at the club's website, www.raotc.org.au. These news broadcasts are available for download for up to 6 months, just in case you miss the original broadcast or want to listen to it again, from the club's website. That website once again is www.raotc.org.au.
Hello there. I'm Bill Roper, VK3BR, with RAOTC Club News. New member. I'm pleased to extend a warm welcome to new club member number 1839, Ian Bedson, VK5ZBI. Welcome, Ian. Silent Key. It is with sadness that I report the passing of Kevin Parsons, VK2JS. Kevin passed away in 2021, but I've only recently been advised. Let us pause for a few moments in memory of our departed colleague. New RAOTC bank account, and this is most important. The RAOTC no longer banks with Westpac, and now has an account with the Bendigo Bank. It is important that all club members are aware of this change when paying monies to the club. Full details of our new banking arrangements appear on the reverse side of the address fly sheet that was with your copy of the September edition of OTN Journal, and also on the RAOTC's website. September edition of OTN Journal. This edition of OTN, unfortunately, was delayed by a week in being posted out to club members due to the unexpected change of bankers. It was sent to the post office last Monday, the 29th of August, and members should already have received their copy. If you have not received your copy in the post as yet, hopefully it should arrive very shortly. AGM 2022. This year's AGM will take place on Thursday, the 15th of September, and will be conducted online using Zoom. All wishing to participate will need to register their participation by Thursday, the 8th of September, and full details of this are on the back page of September's OTN and also on the RAOTC's website. The committee looks forward to a good turnout from members all around Australia. Melbourne September Luncheon. This luncheon will take place on Thursday, the 22nd of September. Full details are on the back page of September's OTN and also on the RAOTC's website. Please note that this luncheon will take place at a new location, the Caulfield RSL, and all monies paid by electronic funds transfer to attend must be paid to the RAOTC's new bank account at the Bendigo Bank. Of course, you can also pay by a cheque in the mail. And now over to Ron Cook, VK3AFW.
A couple of my local radio club members are living in retirement or aged care facilities and are no longer on the air, and another one is soon to join them. I hope we can keep him on air and perhaps get a couple of the others back as well. If you are entering into such a place, the first thing to do is to inquire about pursuing your hobby. Many of these places have a men's shed, which is equipped with a bench and a few tools and maybe a wood turning lathe. You might be able to set up a station there if it seems too hard to do it in your room. A fairly modern all-band, all-mode station needs only about 7 inches by 9 inches footprint, and with a power supply, an ATU would take up perhaps 10 inches in height. maybe a little less. This can easily be fitted into a cupboard or lockable drawer in a cabinet. What to do about the aerial? Well, wire antennas covering two or more bands can be erected with minimal visual impact. Mobile whips can be mounted on a balcony rail. A multi-band vertical might be able to be erected on the men's shed. I have seen CB antennas in exactly that situation. A slim jim hung from the blind rail will improve the capability of a handheld radio. Of course, you won't necessarily have the station set up that is as good as the one you had before, but given a compromise or two, almost anything is possible. If you do find yourself in a retirement facility where not even a small whip is allowed, and you decide radio is too hard to set up, don't forget you can use not just email, but Skype to keep in contact. Most facilities these days have a community computer for just such a purpose. Otherwise, you might be able to get an internet cable or a Wi-Fi connection in your room. And there's always the USB telephone broadband connection, which should be feasible for around $20 per month. And, as a last resort, there is the pen and paper.
Thanks, Ron. That article was first broadcast in 2012, and many aspects of it are still relevant today. What wasn't mentioned was there are now other ways to keep an active interest in what's on air. There are a multitude of software-defined radios, or SDRs, which you can listen to, located throughout the world. And these allow you to listen to what's going on the various HF bands. Often the signals you hear are a higher quality than what you may have once had at home. In addition to SDRs, there is a system called Echolink. Echolink allows you to connect to a VHF or UHF repeater via the internet from anywhere in the world using a personal computer or mobile phone device. These work by using a transceiver that's within the range of a repeater and extend the microphone and loudspeaker to the internet connected device. The software to use it is free and is available for all popular operating systems, be it Apple, Microsoft Windows, Android, and even Linux. You must, however, be registered to use Echolink, and once again, this is also free. As part of the registration process, you'll be asked to furnish details of your amateur license and usually some form of ID, such as a passport or a driver's license, to ensure the registered user is indeed who they say they are. Now, it's over to Clive, VK6CSW, who tells us a little about some early electromechanically tuned radios.
With a whir and a clunk. If you've seen the electromechanical tuning mechanism of the SCR522 VHF RT set in operation, you'd never forget how it whirred and clunked when changing channels. Many old-timers will remember these sets, and for some it will have been their introduction to voice communications on 2 meters and possibly even 6 meters. I was lucky enough to have used the set for its original purpose as an airborne VHF radio telephone during my RAF pilot training in 1955. What was the SCR-522 and how did it come about? SCR, by the way, means Set Complete Radio, the term dating back to World War I, when it was one of several designators used by the American Army Signals Corps to describe equipment purposes. The SCR-522 was a voice-only, 4-channel, crystal-controlled aircraft VHF transmitter-receiver covering 100 to 156 megahertz. Built in America, mostly by the Bendix Radio Corporation, and introduced into service in 1943. Specifically, it was a BC625A 8-valve VHF transmitter and a BC624A 10-valve VHF receiver, each tuned by a motorized tuning unit, all housed in a single case. Power came from a separately housed rotary transformer, or dynamotor unit, operating from the aircraft's DC power supply. The complete RT system weighed about 100 pounds, or 46 kilograms, consumed around 300 watts, and had an RF power output of about 8 watts. The set was based on the British design TR-1143 VHF RT set, and was the most widely used RT set during World War II. Although the two sets differed internally, the British and American sets were interchangeable, a feature of prime importance during World War II, with so many British and American aircraft operating together. The story behind the SCR-522 began with pre-war RAF fighter radio communications. Few people these days realize that most of the Spitfires and Hurricanes, which fought the Battle of Britain in 1940, communicated via HF, not VHF, between themselves and their sector controllers, the men who guided the fighters towards the attacking German aircraft. The HF set used in most RAF fighters until 1941 was the TR-9D, a simple battery-powered AM transmitter receiver covering 4.3 to 6.6 MHz. Its two-channel crystal-controlled transmitter had a power output of just 1 watt, while the single-channel receiver was a simple TRF type. It wasn't even a superhead. Low power and a short, inefficient wire aerial restricted the air-to-air range to about 5 miles, while the air-to-ground range was some 35 to 40 miles, due to the more powerful ground equipment with better aerials. It didn't take a Spitfire long to cover 40 miles. To overcome this limited range, HF repeater stations, linked by landline back to sector operation centres, were installed at strategic locations. Britain's Chaim Home radar defences looked out to sea and could only track German raiders until they crossed the coast. By the same token, RAF fighters scrambled from inland airfields could not be radar tracked. To overcome this problem, the second channel of the TR-9D transmitter was used for a direction-finding system codenamed Pipsqueak. A clockwork-driven contactor unit in the fighter caused the HF set to transmit a carrier for 14 seconds of each minute, during which time the pilot's RT was inoperative. Ground-based CRDF stations took bearings on these transmissions, which enabled the sector controller to know the whereabouts of his aircraft and to vector them towards the incoming German raiders. Pipsqueak was switched off prior to engagement to allow pilots continuous RT contact. Perhaps the miracle was that these obsolescent 1930s radios, powered by a 2-volt accumulator and a 150-volt HT battery, worked well enough for the RAF to win the Battle of Britain, but clearly something better was needed. Just prior to the war, the RAF had ordered for evaluation a small number of hand-built VHF four-channel amplitude-modulated transmitter receivers designated TR-1133. These sets, which covered 100 to 156 MHz, had a 10-watt crystal-controlled transmitter, a VFO-controlled receiver, both tuned electromechanically, plus an audio amplifier for transmitter modulation and receiver output, all housed in a single box weighing about 45 pounds. The receiver IF bandwidth was 300 kHz, giving some leeway for drift. Two impulse-type electric motors drove the tuning mechanism, which selected the appropriate transmitter crystal and operated a number of slides, cams, rods, and bell cranks to mechanically position five tuning circuits in the transmitter and three circuits in the receiver to any one of four preset channels, hence all the whirring and clunking as channels were changed. Each channel was pre-tuned prior to flight, and the transmitter could be either manually keyed or vox-operated. A modified Pipsqueak DF system using the same clockwork contactor mechanism as the HF set could be operated on each channel. From the pilot's perspective, HF and VHF Pipsqueak were much the same, though technically they were quite different. Power for the set came from a rotary transformer housed in a separate box. All up, the complete VHF-RT system weighed over 100 pounds, significantly heavier than the TR9D, but of much better performance. The companion VHF ground equipment was a 50-watt crystal-controlled transmitter and a VFO-tuned receiver, which, like the TR1133 airborne receiver, had an IF bandwidth of 300 kHz. If the use of VFO tuning at VHF seems unusual, we must remember that in Britain, at the start of World War II, supplies of quartz and crystal manufacturing facilities were limited. It was only later in the war that crystal production was hugely expanded. In October 1939, a month after hostilities began, six fighters of No. 66 Squadron commenced flight evaluation of the new VHF system. With an air-to-ground range of as much as 140 miles and an air-to-air range of over 100 miles, the superiority of VHF over HF was irrefutable, and a few days later, the Chief of Air Staff approved the general introduction of VHF-RT into fighter command. Unfortunately, production delays prevented all RAF fighter squadrons from being re-equipped with VHF prior to the start of the Battle of Britain in July 1940, and in May 1940, with German air attack now inevitable, the decision was made to revert to the old-fashioned HF set. Fortunately, the TR1133 connectors had been made compatible with those of the TR9D, and it was possible to change over the radios and antennas of an entire fighter squadron in just a few hours. As more 1133 sets became available, they were introduced during the Battle of Britain, but by the battle's end in October 1940, HF still predominated. The changeover from HF to VHF was not completed until early March 1941. The next step was to crystal control the TR1133's receiver, and from this, the mass production version, the TR1143, was born, but it still used the same electromechanical tuning arrangement. By mid-1941, almost all 1133s had been replaced by 1143s, and by 1942, the TR1143 was in large-scale mass production. America entered World War II in December 1941. Within a year, huge numbers of American warplanes were operating from RAF aerodromes in England, but because the Americans still used HF in preference to VHF, there were major problems with radio communications compatibility, especially with airfield control and where formations of British and American aircraft operated together. A joint USA-UK decision was made to produce a copy of the TR-1143 built in America. The British also wanted a second source of supply should their own factories be destroyed through German bombing. The outcome was that the US Army Signals Corps completely redesigned the TR-1143 internally, using valves and other components more suited to American production facilities, but packaged it in a case with plugs and sockets compatible with the TR-1143. The number of electromechanically tuned circuits was reduced from 3 to 2 in the receiver and from 5 to 4 in the transmitter. The result was the set complete radio type 522 four-channel VHF RT set. From a user perspective, all three sets, the TR1133, 43 and the SCR522, were interchangeable. In those days, most British fighters had a 12-volt DC electrical system, whereas the Americans generally used 24 volts. Two dynamotor power supplies, one for each voltage, took care of this. The final twist to the story came with the introduction of the Air Ministry TR5043, in effect, the British version of the SCR522. However, the internals were slightly different, and the build quality of the US version was said to be somewhat superior. These VHF sets were fitted to just about every Allied military aircraft that flew during the latter years of World War II, and many sets remained in use until the 1960s. Even then, Not all were pensioned off. Many were used as emergency battery-powered ground-to-air radios in control towers, especially in Australia. Less well known is that the SCR-522 was used by the Navy and by the Army, the latter having a 12-volt vehicle version known as the SCR-542, which was used mainly for forward aircraft control. Post-war, huge quantities of these sets found their way onto the surplus market, and many old-timers will recall buying or even grinding suitable crystals to adapt them to 2-meter AM. Few, if any, will have restored that remarkable mechanical tuning system to working order simply because there was no need, but I can assure you, watching it whir and clunk was a memorable experience. When changing channels, there was a distinct pause as the electromechanics operated, during which time one just hoped that everything really would work, and it nearly always did.
You're listening to VK3OTN, the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia. The year 2022 is anniversary time for many broadcasters. There are several very important anniversaries being celebrated in 2022 by some well-known broadcasters. Many were founded by amateur operators nearly 100 years ago. The ABC is celebrating 90 years, along with Melbourne commercial broadcaster 3AW, celebrating 100 years of British broadcasting. And this article was sourced from the pages of QRZ.com by the BBC Amateur Radio Club. In 2022, the British Broadcasting Corporation is marking 100 years of broadcasting. The BBC Staff Amateur Radio Club, the Ariel Radio Group, was established in 1945, and there has been some form of ham radio club at the BBC ever since. The current team, the London BBC Radio Group, have secured the call sign GB100BBC to help in the celebrations. GB100BBC will be on air from the main shack at BBC Broadcasting House in central London and from other BBC premises and members' home QTHs around the UK. We are indebted to Ofcom, the UK regulator, which has permitted the call sign to be used for the entirety of 2022. Early BBC history. The British Broadcasting Company, as it was then called, was founded on 18th October 1922 by a group of wireless manufacturers. The Marconi Company was one of the group. A broadcasting studio was constructed within Marconi House on the Strand, London. The medium wave transmitter was housed in the same building with antennas on the roof. The station was allocated the call sign 2LO. LO was for London. In the original 2LO transmitter, 22,500 volts ran through the system. The power output was 1.5 kilowatts on 820 kilohertz. At 5:33 p.m. on the 14th of November 1922, regular programming commenced with a mixture of news, music, drama and talks. Programs were initially broadcast for just a few hours a day. By 1926, the transmission power had increased to 3 kilowatts when an improved transmitter was established with antennas on the roof of Selfridge's department store in London. Their studios were located at Savoy Hill. Several regional transmitters were installed around the UK carrying the same programming. The public were required to purchase a radio receiving licence costing 10 shillings per annum. That equates to around £60 in today's currency, or around about 120 Australian dollars. In 1927, the British Broadcasting Corporation was established by Royal Charter and a Director General, Sir John Reef, was appointed. In November of the same year, Marconi used his Chelmsford base to make experimental Empire broadcast on 11750 kHz using the call sign G5SW with a power of 12 kilowatts. In 1930, King George V spoke to the whole British Empire from the House of Lords via the Chelmsford transmitting system, and 9510 kHz was added. By 1932, the BBC had outgrown the Savoy Hill studios and a purpose-built centre was being commissioned. Broadcasting House was opened in May, with many architectural features created by the modernised designs of the day. The Empire Service was formally inaugurated that December, with many programs from the new centre. In November 1936, the BBC started the television service with studios and a transmitter located at Alexandra Palace, a high point in North London that looked down over much of the city. It didn't last long. On the 1st of September 1939, at the outbreak of war, it was closed down with no official explanation, but it has been speculated that authorities were worried that the strong broadcast signal would act as an aid to enemy aircraft. The last program to be viewed was Mickey Mouse's gala premiere. When TV returned in June 1946, the same Mickey Mouse program was the first thing to be aired. The BBC commenced foreign language radio broadcasting in January 1938 with a program in Arabic. This was soon followed by many more languages. In 1941, the BBC external service was transferred to their own building, Bush House. Now, for those working GB100 BBC, here is some QSL information. The team at the BBC Radio Group look forward to working you. We are not able to issue a schedule of our operations, but we hope you will find us using all bands and modes throughout 2022. A special commemorative QSL card will be available by the Traditional Bureau. We will send out a card upon receipt of your incoming card. You can also QSL via Logbook of the World and eQSL. Please carefully note we are unable to QSL directly under any circumstances. Please do not send any cards to the BBC Broadcasting House or to the participating individual club members. You will unfortunately not receive a response. And this article was sourced from the pages of QRZ.com by the BBC Amateur Radio Club.
Hello everyone, this is Clive, VK6 Charlie Sierra Whiskey, reminding you that the next lunchtime meeting for members and friends of the RAOTC is at the Bayswater Hotel, Bayswater, starting at around midday, and that the buffet is back on the menu once again. Everyone's welcome to join in and have an eyeball QSO, but do remember that WA public health rules apply in all restaurants.
You are listening to VK3OTN and associated relay stations. And in keeping with tradition, we conclude this month's broadcast with a short story. A disreputable-looking man goes into a bar and orders a drink. The bartender says, "No way, I don't think you can pay for it." "You're right," the man says, "I don't have any money, but if I show you something you haven't seen before, would you give me a drink?" "Only if it's not risque," says the bartender. "Deal," the man says, and reaches into his pocket and pulls out a hamster. It runs across the room, up to the piano, jumps on the keyboard, and starts playing Gershwin. The bartender gives the man a drink, saying, "You're right. I've never seen anything like that before, and he's really good." The man downs the drink and asks for another. "Money or another miracle, or else no drink," says the bartender. The man reaches into his coat and pulls out a frog. He puts it on the bar, and the frog starts to sing, beautifully. A stranger rushes over and offers the man $300 for the frog. "It's a deal," the man says, taking the money.
He gives the frog to the stranger, who runs out of the bar. "Are you crazy?" says the bartender. "You sold a singing frog for $300. It must be worth millions." "Not so," says the man. "The hamster is also a ventriloquist."
That's about all we have for you this month, and we hope you found something of interest. Thanks for being with us, and we hope you will join in the callbacks, where callbacks are taken. We look forward to being with you on the first Monday of next month. 73 from VK3 OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia.